good evening, everyone. Thanks a lot for coming. Can everyone hear it okay at the back?
Yeah.
That's all right, is it? Yeah. Okay. Kicking off our weekend, our living the dream, being a socialist in a capitalist world weekend of talks and discussion. We have a guest speaker who's kindly offered to get the weekend started. And so I'd like to welcome Edmund Griffiths from the Oxford Communist Correspondence Society, which is a discussion group who's a few of us in the Socialist Party know. And he's also the author of Towards the Science of Belief Systems. So maybe check out and try and get hold of a copy of the book afterwards. Not sure if you brought any copies along to sign. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Edmund Griffiths on Be Realistic, Demand the Inevitable. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks, everyone, for coming. And I'm grateful to the Socialist Party for the opportunity to speak. I'm glad Mike plugged my book, partly because it's always nice to have my book plugged, and also because the alert that I'm interested in belief systems means that if I do start talking about ghosts and space aliens and flying saucers and Brexit and so on, then you won't be too surprised, because one or two of those things, I warn you now, may come up over the course of what I'm going to say. The title, Be Realistic, Demand the Inevitable, is, of course, an adaptation of the slogan that was popular in Paris 1968, Be Realistic, Demand the Impossible. And that's a good slogan too, but I sort of think that mine is better, and I hope by the end I might have persuaded you to agree with that. But along the way, I'd like to think a little bit with you about impossibility and inevitability and why people might demand impossible things or, indeed, inevitable things. Sherlock Holmes famously said, "Eliminate the impossible and then..." And then something else. I don't remember the exact words of what comes next, but the main thing was eliminate the impossible. But do we want to eliminate the impossible? Did Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of the Sherlock Holmes stories, really want to eliminate the impossible? You may remember the episode of, not a Sherlock Holmes story, but the Cottingley fairy photographs from 1917. Yeah. Photographs taken by two young cousins living at Cottingley in Yorkshire, Elsie Wright and Francis Griffiths, no relation, which supposedly showed the fairies that were at the bottom of their garden. And maybe we're more cynical or we're more sophisticated about recognising faked-up photos, but they don't look enormously convincing now. But they looked quite convincing, probably, in 1917. And among the people who were very convinced by them was Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote a book on the subject, The Coming of the Fairies. And certainly in that instance did not eliminate the impossible. And I think it's not coincidental that he was interested in fairies when fairies are something that many people would think are impossible. That there could not be little people with wings that only children can see, and so on and so forth. Because Conan Doyle was also interested in spiritualism, spirit mediums, psychic abilities, communication with the spirits of the dead, and so on and so forth. He was really much more concerned with all of that than he was with the fairies at the bottom of Francis Griffiths's garden. But the point of fairies for him was that if you've got clear proof, and a photograph that could not have been faked, assuming for the sake of argument that the photograph couldn't have been faked, you've got clear proof of something that scientific materialism says could not be there, then that opens up the door to spirit mediums and the spirits of the dead and all kinds of other things. You've busted through materialism and you've expanded the bounds of what's possible. So that's one reason why something, not something that I think is impossible necessarily, but something that you think is impossible, is very attractive, because it breaks down the limits of what science tells us is possible. And we're told that, oh, you can only have these things and these things, but that, oh no, that's a dream, that's a folklore, that's a fairy tale. You can't have it. But if I've got a photograph of it, then who knows what else might be possible. I emphasise, I don't want to give offence in case there's anyone in the room who is closer to the Leninist political tradition than I am, that I am talking about the Cottingley fairies. I'm not talking about anything else. I'm not using it as a metaphor for anything else that might have happened in 1917 that might also have seemed to bust through what was possible and open up new realms, and that one might be excited about for that reason. But this is something that you see quite a lot, that people, whether because they have a particular commitment to something else, like Conan Doyle had to spiritualism, but people can come to feel that the consensus about the way the world is, that the scientific consensus about the way the world is restrictive, that it squeezes out any possibility for romance or wonderment. And so if you can knock a hole in it, if there can be a Loch Ness Monster, the Loch Ness Monster is not a bad example, because most of the people who are enthusiastic about the Loch Ness Monster, I know somebody who has had training to operate sonar equipment. I mean, it takes the Loch Ness Monster very seriously. But people who are interested in the Loch Ness Monster are not normally very interested in lake fauna in general. They might become so through spending time at Loch Ness and you don't see the monster on the sonar, but you end up getting more interested in seals and fish and so on. I'm sure that can happen. But in general, they're not necessarily enormously interested in other things. And I think if the Loch Ness Monster were proved to exist, if it were proved beyond all doubt to exist, then a small number of marine biologists would care about it a lot more than they do now. But most of the people who read about Loch Ness and take an interest in the Loch Ness Monster would be less interested, because it would just be another boring old thing that exists. The excitement about it is that it probably doesn't exist, but it might. So it's a way of knocking a hole in the consensus. Same is true of people who will tell you that the Sphinx is thousands of years older than Orthodox Egyptology tells you it is. It doesn't make that much difference, really. I mean, for the ordinary member of the public, 4,000 years old, 8,000 years old, 12,000 years old, I mean, do we really have a very strong sense? You know, 4,000 years sounds old already. But the point of that is being able to say, this is something that official Egyptology tells you is impossible, that the Sphinx could have been built 10,000 years ago. So if that might be true, then who knows what else? You can wonder again. You can be free to wonder. We've broken through. And perhaps the ultimate example of that, and I will move on from things that are quite so belief system oriented, but a very good example of this is Flat Earth, which there's been a certain resurgence of in recent years. The belief that the Earth is a flat disk. Because that's really very impossible. If you're going to believe that, I said that if you believe something about the Sphinx, then you've knocked out official Egyptology. But if you can convince yourself to believe that the Earth is flat, then you've knocked out everything. I mean, everything you ever heard at school is out of the window if the Earth is flat. You've lost astronomy completely, physics, meteorology, optics, weather forecasting, any maps or plane flights, you know, an enormous amount has to be different. So while it might take an effort to believe that the Earth is flat, if you can once believe that impossible thing, then you've opened up an infinite realm where you can make up whatever you like. And that's probably up to a point attractive. I suspect there are underlying social reasons why the scientific consensus is felt to be oppressive, why it doesn't feel as though we know the world and that's a good thing, but it feels as though we are dominated and constrained by this knowledge. But I do want to move on, because you might object to what I've said so far by saying that I haven't been talking about believing in things that the believer themselves regards as impossible. It's just that other people think they're impossible, and that's part of the attraction. Flat earthers don't think it's impossible that the Earth is flat, or at least they do their best not to think so. Arthur Conan Doyle did not think it was impossible that there were fairies in Cottingley. But you do also see examples, I think, where people put forward things very much as though they believe them, while really acting in a way as though I'm not quite sure that they do. If you look at the European Research Group, of conservative pro-Brexit members of Parliament. These are people supposedly who've wanted Brexit, wanted Britain to leave the European Union for their whole political lives. This is their central goal and their central objective. But yet, whenever they've been given the opportunity in the House of Commons to vote for that and make it happen, they've come up with excuses why they can't vote for it. And they've behaved as though they would rather see it blocked. They would rather go down gloriously fighting for a Brexit that doesn't end up happening, rather than get a Brexit that might not completely match, incidentally, completely match criteria that they are making up as they go along. I vividly remember Eurosceptics holding up Norway as an example of what Britain could have. Well, now they think it's unacceptable because it's become possible. And I think what's going on here is two things. One of them is a strategy. It's something that they're conscious of. And the other, maybe they're not quite so conscious of it. It's a matter of instinct. And the strategy, I think, is that they would like politics to be all about leave versus remain until the end of time. They would like a kind of American-style culture wars politics where leave is Republicans and remain is Democrats, and other issues don't get a look in. And they get that in a supercharged way if Brexit can be betrayed, if it can be blocked by Brussels, or it can be betrayed by MPs. And that's sort of why I wasn't terribly surprised that they all endorsed Boris Johnson for leader of the Conservative Party. Because if you want a true believer, someone who's really going to deliver Brexit, then I'm not convinced that Boris Johnson is your man. But if you want somebody who has no convictions beyond his own self-aggrandizement, so that he will say he'll deliver Brexit, but then if it gets difficult, he might turn around and betray it, then he's exactly the candidate that you're looking for. So I think, to a certain extent, it's a manoeuvre. And with some of the others, it's more that leaving the European Union was something that they were perfectly happy making a noise about it, but they never really thought it was going to happen. They'd spent their lives hammering on the firmly closed door, because that gives them a standpoint. Demanding this impossible thing gives them a standpoint then to justify all their other policies that they might hope to implement. And then suddenly the door swings open. And that's a bit difficult. They then need to readjust. So I think there's an element there of demanding something even that they thought was impossible. And if you want another example, I would point you again, without meaning to give offence to people from a particular political tradition, but I would point you to the idea of transitional demands that you hear of from Trotsky and his admirers. Now, the idea of a transitional demand is that it's something that you can get up a movement around that sounds as though the ruling class could grant it, but in fact you think they couldn't really. So you tell people, oh, why don't we demand full employment? That's a reasonable thing, that's not overturning the whole of society. Why couldn't they give us full employment? Yeah, we'll do a march for full employment. But actually you think capitalism couldn't grant it. So you'll trickshot people into wanting to abolish capitalism because it can't grant your seemingly reasonable demand. So in that case, you are consciously putting forward something that you take to be impossible. You don't actually believe that these demands could be attained within the capitalist order, but you present them as though you believe that they could be attained. So that's a clear case, not maybe a very noble case, but a clear case of demanding the impossible. At least it seems to be. And I will just say in parentheses, I'm not wholly convinced that that's what's really going on. That's what members of those organisations tell one another is going on. And it's very tempting to think that what people say in private must be true and what they say in public must be a lie, assuming that the two are different. Like if... like in private life, you think that if somebody says one thing to your face and another thing behind your back, you assume that it's to your face that they're lying. If you go up to a speaker after a talk and say, gosh, that was interesting, I enjoyed the fairies bit, for the sake of argument, and then the speaker overhears you saying, what a load of rubbish. What a load of old rubbish. Fairies... Did we come here to listen to fairies? I'm an entirely hypothetical, made-up example. But if the speaker then overhears that, then the speaker would assume that you'd been lying to him, that you'd been lying when you spoke to him, and telling the truth when you're talking to somebody else. Because there's no reason why you should be. I mean, evidently you're telling the truth one time and you're lying the other time. But maybe you're trying to curry favour with the other person. Maybe the person you're talking to, you think they won't have liked it, so you're bad-mouthing it, even though actually you did. Actually, you did enjoy it. Remember that. Even though actually you did enjoy it, you're bad-mouthing it because you think that'll make you seem more with it. In itself, you can't tell. If somebody says one thing to me and another thing to somebody else, I can't tell just from that which one is the truth. You might remember a political scandal from a few years ago. And it just stuck with me because I feel that for this reason it was misinterpreted. This was maybe 10 years ago or something like that. The Hungarian Prime Minister of the time, from the Social Democratic Party, this was before Orban and so on, successfully won re-election. And then a tape emerged of him speaking privately to his party team, saying, "My God, we lied and lied and lied and got away with it. Has any government ever been so incompetent as we were? I can't believe they fell for it. For the last 2 years, we haven't known what we were doing." And so on and so forth. Well, I mean, that kind of brought his career to a close, because people assumed that when he'd been speaking on the platform to the electorate, saying, "We have a plan, blah, blah, blah," that had been the lie. And when he was talking privately, saying it was all nonsense, that time he was telling the truth. Well, I mean, maybe he was. Maybe in that case it was that way around. But it doesn't have to be that way around, because the way a politician talks on the stump, I mean, present company except, I know there are people in the room who have contested elections in an entirely honest and above board way. But usually, the way a politician speaks on the stump to the electorate, they say certain things, you know, there are forms to it, they claim that they have a plan and a solution and so on. But I suggest that also the way you talk to your cynical, hard-bitten campaign team is probably also quite formalised. And the last thing you want to do to that audience is come across as though you're all starry-eyed and you believe it. So even if you did kind of believe what you'd been saying to the public, I think you would still want to seem cynical, or you might still want to seem cynical. You might say, yeah, we lied, those mugs bought it. Even if actually you weren't quite so cynical about it. And I suggest to you that people who advocate transitional demands aren't always being honest about which side it is that they're lying about. In other words, they say to one another, you know, we'll say that these demands are achievable, but they're not. And then they go out and say to the general public, these are some achievable demands, let's try to achieve them. But I think it's quite possible that actually they basically believe the reformist things that they say to the general public. And the idea that it's a transitional demand is an excuse that they tell themselves to say, oh no, I am still really trying to abolish capitalism, even though I never talk about it. But be that as it may, a demand that starts out as impossible, or a belief that starts out as impossible, can evolve to the point where it seems as though it is achievable. And I'll give you an example of that, which is Scottish independence. When the Scottish National Party got going, or the National Party of Scotland, as it was in its early days, sort of late 20s, early 30s, Scottish independence, I mean, it might not have seemed physically impossible the way fairies at the bottom of your garden might seem physically impossible. But it would have seemed like a fairly remote and quixotic objective. And perhaps for that reason, it was in a certain way exciting. And the early Scottish National Party could attract romantic conservatives or renegade communists in a way that it might not be able to today, when its objective seems much more this worldly, seems like something that there's a plausible route to it happening. Now, obviously, part of the reason why it's more plausible is that it has wider support, that there is wider support for independence in Scotland now than there was many decades ago. But the two things are related in another way, which is that I think a lot of people in Scotland, if you'd asked them in 1930, do you support independence for Scotland? Well, I mean, they might have said yes or they might have said no, but the answer wouldn't have meant a great deal because they wouldn't have thought that the question was a realistic one. They'd have thought, well, why are you asking me this when it isn't going to happen? Because I think in general, a lot of people only come up with their opinion about questions that they think are really asked. I suggest to you that a lot of people in Britain today don't really have an opinion about the monarchy, pro or anti, because they don't think it's going anywhere. They don't think they're going to have to choose between a monarchy and a republic. So it's not a real question. You don't get a sensible answer. I mean, I'm sceptical of opinion polls in general for all kinds of reasons. But that sort of opinion poll, asking somebody, would you prefer a republic or would you rather keep the monarchy, doesn't feel like a real question because it's not gonna come up.
Just 2 points.
Sorry, can we confine discussion until the end, please?
All right, thank you very much.
I'll make some progress. So the same, I would say, can be said of socialism and capitalism. Certainly it's true that not a huge number of people support replacing capitalism with socialism. But I think it's probably true that also a relatively small number firmly oppose that idea, because a lot of people don't give it a vast amount of consideration one way or the other. Either the question doesn't cross their mind, or if it does cross their mind, they think, well, it's not going to happen anyway. I'm not going to bother about something that isn't actually on the agenda. Not so crude as that people like to be on the winning side. But I think a lot of people don't like to be on the impossible side. Although others, for reasons that I've suggested, and for other reasons, don't mind it. So part of the support for the status quo is that it's inevitable in the sense that it's unchangeable. But also, I suggest a good argument. This is why I suggest the slogan, demand the inevitable, is that socialism is inevitable. Now, by inevitable, I don't necessarily mean that it's bound to happen, although it sounds as though that's what inevitable means. My impression of the Marxist position is that socialism is inevitable in the sense that socialism is the only actual answer or the only actual solution to the problems that are faced by current society or the problems that are posed by the development of capitalism. The fact that it's the only actual solution does not guarantee in itself that the solution will be reached. Like, there's only one correct answer to 13 times 13. But that doesn't prove that I'll be able to work it out. I could keep getting it wrong for a long time. But in fact, there is only one solution to that problem. And this is something that cannot be said for transitional demands or for demands that might seem to be more realistic because they seem to be closer to where we are now. I think the fact that something seems to be closer to where we are now, you know, like if you want to get from this side of the river to the other side of the river, you might think, well, an achievable, realistic demand would be just there. But if that's in the middle of the water, then that's not a very realistic place to stand. So the argument for abolishing capitalism rather than trying to rejig it doesn't rest on the transitional demands point exactly, or the point that this particular thing could never be achieved. Because I think that's a little bit, I mean, aside from the dishonesty of doing it in the transitional demands sense, it's not self-evident what particular demand capitalism could or couldn't come good on. Could capitalism deliver full employment? Well, I dare say it could. What it couldn't, in principle, deliver is a society with public ownership, without class division, without exploitation, etc. So if you do want to demand something that capitalism can't give you, then demanding something that isn't capitalism or campaigning for something that isn't capitalism might be a good way to do it. And I think the honesty point is perhaps relevant as well, because saying demand the inevitable or argue for the inevitable is in a sense another way of saying be honest, argue for the thing that you actually think, rather than for what sounds realistic or sounds attractive to a particular audience. And that, I think, probably is quite important in the same way that that using democratic methods is important. And I understand in a way why people sometimes doubt that and think, well, you know, it's all about, you know, why be pedantic about being honest and being democratic. You know, let's take a shortcut. Let's get there with a shortcut. And there's nothing wrong with a shortcut. I mean, I have no objection at all to a shortcut. The only thing that I ask of a shortcut is that it goes where I want to go. And using undemocratic or dishonest or demagogic methods, I suspect it doesn't go where I want to go, if where I want to go is a society of
freedom where people are actually capable of running things in the common interest. Because each time you prod them or bully them or whatever, you might get your way, but you're not raising people's ability then to do things for themselves. You're lowering it. You're encouraging, you're pushing people to be more suited to a hierarchical society rather than a socialist one. Sorry, that may have been slightly off topic. I mean, I should go back to fairies and the Loch Ness Monster, which was exactly on topic. But instead, I'll probably wrap things up because I've been taking up a certain amount of your time already. So to conclude, be realistic and demand the inevitable mean the same thing. They mean arguing for what you actually think, describing things the way they actually are, and suggesting the solutions that you think are the right solutions to those problems. And that's why I think that's a good slogan, and in its way just as snappy as Demand the Impossible. And I will leave it there. Thank you.
Right, thank you very much. Yeah, plenty of food for thought there. And I'm sure a couple of us have got a few questions or discussion points.